The following podcast is a live recording of a radio show first broadcast by Fresh FM with assistance from New Zealand On Air.
Kia ora and welcome to Spirited Conversations, a locally produced live recording of a keynote speaker. I'm Jan Marsh for Fresh FM and the Spirited Conversations Committee. Recently, Karina Shannon led a spirited conversation at Yaza Cafe on language's power, getting our kids talking. Here, I introduce the evening.
Tēnā koutou kāpō. Welcome everyone, it's lovely to see you here. I would like to introduce Karina Shannon. Karina's going to talk to us on a very pertinent subject, language's power, getting our kids talking. In preparing for this talk, I was introduced to the term oracy, which it took a little moment to get my head around, but Karina will explain a great deal more about it. But I thought, like literacy, so it's balanced. Karina has an interesting career as a speech-language therapist and a primary school teacher, and so she's worked across all levels of education since the early 1980s. She's very passionate about the growing number of Tamariki who are not well served and they have poor oracy. So she's on a mission to raise the awareness of these children and to improve their access to support. In order to do that, she's part of a recently formed organisation, Oracy Aotearoa. So she'll tell us more about that as well. So without further ado, I would like to invite Karina to come and take the podium and speak to you.
Kia ora koutou katoa. Just going to start with a little blessing, one to settle my nerves and also to bless our gathering here tonight. So, whakataka te hau ki te uru, whakataka te hau ki te tonga, kia mā kina kina ki uta, kia mā taratara ki tai, he hia ki ana te atakura, hei tio, hei huka, hei hauhu, ti hei Māori ora. Well, thank you all very much for the opportunity. It is an area of passionate interest to me, and I hope that I can convey some of that passion to you tonight. You know, I think that's what Karen chose to write on the flyer, that language is power, and getting our kids talking is certainly at the heart of why we're kind of very happy to accept this invitation tonight. So I'm just going to start, you know, not my favourite topic, but I just thought maybe I'll just give you a little bit of a rundown about me and some of my background. So I was born in the Nelson Hospital and grew up for the first sort of 18 years of my life in Nelson, and at which time I went away to Christchurch to do my nursing training. I'd been a nurse aide up at Braemar Hospital, and that gave me, you know, the kind of impetus to think that nursing was my future. But although I really enjoyed certain aspects of nursing, the hierarchy wasn't one of them. So we kind of agreed to have a parting of the ways a couple of years into it, and what I decided that really was my passion and had started at Braemar Hospital from working alongside one of the communication assistants there was speech therapy. So I joined the speech therapy training in Canterbury. At that stage, that was the only place that did speech language therapy training in New Zealand. There's several places do it now. But I did want to give you a little bit of background about how we did it, because what happened when I trained was that we trained, first of all, we did a year as general teacher training, and then we applied to do the specialist training as speech language therapist. So it was a 3-year course, and we came out with a primary teacher diploma as well as our speech therapy training. And I believe that was a distinct advantage, because it meant that, you know, I had experience in the classroom and across all levels of education. Nowadays, and probably for the last 20 odd years, speech language therapy training in New Zealand is a 4-year degree course. It's become a great deal more pathologised and medicalised than it was when I trained, and I think that this group of children that I feel most passionately about they've almost been an unintended consequence of that professionalisation of speech language therapy in New Zealand, because Most of the children that I'll talk about tonight don't qualify for a funded service from speech language therapists. So I think that's something that has served them rather badly. And I think we're now seeing, that's why I believe that we're seeing an intergenerational issue in New Zealand of poor oracy. And I know oracy is a new word and some people don't like it, but I'm trying to colonise it, so I'm going to use it as often as possible tonight. Because it's more than oral language to me. It's oracy is the ability to both understand and use spoken language. So I think it's a bit like you can't just say literacy is reading. I don't think you can just say oracy is talking. It's more than that. And, you know, one of the things that, the reason that I'm able to stand up here tonight, however badly a job I make of it, is that I have oracy skills and I'm able to, you know, speak about what I feel and what I believe and hopefully in some kind of coherent and logical way. And, you know, just to have the confidence to do that and the skills to do a reasonable job of it is something that maybe I've taken for granted for some of my life, but I don't anymore. And I've been working with low oracy children since I first qualified. I think it's worth mentioning that I qualified, the night of my qualification was the Erebus crash, so it was somewhat overshadowed, not surprisingly. You know, but I have been working with children with low oracy since the early 80s. My first clinic was in Kawerau. My friend laughed really hard until she found out she got Huntley. Because we were considered, you know, single and unattached, and where they could send us wherever they wanted. So basically that is what happened. And I was a little bit nervous about Kawerau. I'd never been there. However, I was pleasantly surprised by an absolutely stunningly well-equipped clinic as part of the central school in Kawerau. And I guess, you know, it gave me a really interesting insight into provincial New Zealand. I hadn't had that exposure growing up in Nelson. I don't mean about the provincial, but it was a different kind of exposure than what happens in Kawerau. And also I think training in Canterbury was, you know, it would be fair to say most of our demographic was fairly pale. And so going from there to Kawerau was a bit of a culture shock for me. I'm sure it was for some of my clients as well. But, you know, the thing that, you know, what they say is what doesn't flatten you makes you stronger. I really felt like it was a great privilege to have that as my first clinic. But I also felt that disconnect, I think, quite quickly into the job, that I had a little boy whose parents had dropped him off in the waiting room and sped down the drive because I think they were just so shy about professionals and all the rest of it. So I went out to collect this little boy called Muku, and you know, he was bare feet and he actually had quite a severe hearing loss that had only been picked up when he'd arrived at school. He came from a really tiny community in Ruatuki. And, you know, I was trying to assess this boy with the English picture vocab and I was thinking, this is so wrong. This is so wrong. The pictures I'm showing him, he will have never seen in his life, and then we're going to make some decisions about his intelligence, etc., etc. And so I kind of had a rather panicked SOS call to one of my lecturers down in Christchurch, who was amazing, actually. We had a fantastic, you know, team of lecturers at Speech Language Therapy School. And I said, Anne, I said, whatever training I've done in the last 3 years, it did not prepare me for what I've just struck in this clinic. And she said, well, that's interesting. She said, shall we send an AV team up to film you? And I was thinking, well, no, that's not what I had in mind. I was like, hell. Anyway, that's what they did. And apparently they used that video for some time within the training school, because it truly was, you know, most of us were going off to clinics in small rural areas of New Zealand, and our training was, you know, somewhat limited in terms of what we had to offer and how culturally appropriate it was. So I learned a huge amount in that year I was there. A senior clinician was based in Whakatane and a little bit of a sort of, how do you describe it? Well, she just didn't like going out, you know, so I didn't see very much of her at all. So it was a bit of a sink or swim arrangement. However, my friend from Huntley and I used to get together fairly regularly to compare notes, and it was an amazing experience, which I have absolutely no doubt whatsoever that I learned a great deal more than I ever taught anyone. But, you know, we were travelling around the schools, we were travelling around tiny little you know, areas like Utuiti, Te Mahui, you know, tiny places with just one and two teacher schools. But that's the thing, we did travel around and we were connected with the schools and we were very much part of the staff rooms and the conversations that went on. And so I felt like, although, you know, the children that I would describe as having low oracy, they would have made up probably 25% of my clinic role, and they don't make up any clinic roles anymore because there aren't clinics. It's much more of a consultancy service. So I think all of these things have helped contribute to why we have a very significant component of our population, particularly from poor households. Up to 80% of the children starting school in some of the low decile schools in South Auckland have been assessed as having significant oracy needs. So, you know, 8 out of 10 kids, that's, to me, that's kind of something we should be very worried about and be, you know, developing a service specifically for those tamariki. But in my experience, that is not happening in any kind of planned or thorough manner. So it's part of what's in kind of galvanised, I guess, myself and some others to set up Oracy Aotearoa, and our tagline is helping tamariki become confident communicators, because one of the things that we really want to do is raise awareness of this group of children. We want to make sure that they are, you know, people know they're there, you know, their needs are being appropriately addressed, and that we're working much more at a whānau level to make, because that's what I see, is that now I've worked with three generations of families whose oracy skills are poor, you know, and it's not because, you know, sometimes I hear that kind of comment, oh, well, they just should talk to their kids. Well, you know, if you haven't been talked to, you can't give what you don't have. So, you know, I think we have to really think about how we support and encourage and train people in you know, what helps and what hinders oracy development. So that's why I'm just delighted to have this opportunity tonight to talk a little bit about my work in Nelson. I came back to Nelson, having lived away from Nelson for probably the middle part of my life. I came back here about 24 years ago, and for just over 20 of those years, I've been working on an oracy promotion program at Stoke School. It's been a phenomenally successful program. We've kept really good data, really good assessments. I think one of the things that I find really frustrating is, however much I tried to tell the powers that be that how successful it was and how effective it was, there just didn't seem to be that much interest, because what I've noticed of recent times, probably the last 20 years, we've had a huge focus on literacy and numeracy, and oracy's dropped right off the radar. You know, it's a term that was coined in the 60s. It's only just beginning to be used again, and I think, you know, that it's made, you know, I hadn't planned for it to be timely, but I think it is an added bonus that it's been picked up in several other parts of the world, in the UK, particularly in Ireland and in Wales and Scotland. I think it's interesting where there's been a revitalisation of the Indigenous languages. That's been possibly one of the areas that have been most enthusiastic about oracy, because oracy is at the heart of most of our Indigenous languages, certainly for Māori and Pacifica. We know that their, you know, their whole kind of the emphasis on the oral tradition, and, you know, language was not even, you know, written until relatively recent times for Māori and Pacifica people. And we also know how important it is, and how often it hasn't happened that those translations have actually been accurate or carried the spirit of the, you know, of the Indigenous language. So I think, you know, that's one of the reasons I feel so strongly, because clearly when we're talking about an issue that is overrepresented in low-income households, we're immediately going to be talking about higher numbers of Pacifica and Māori children. So those, you know, that seems even more heartbreaking to me, that's, you know, where that's been a former strength, they are now being represented in the weakest, you know, representatives of it. So It's not about having to establish it, it's about having to recover it. And I think that's a very important distinction to make. Because, you know, often for Māori, one of the things that can really grind the wheels there is, you know, being treated like it's a deficit area. It's always, you talk about us as, you know, a deficit. And this, I think this is more like poorly served than a deficit, you know. So the work that I've been involved with at Stoke School is a program called Hei Awhiawhi Tamariki Ki Te Pānui Puka Puka. So it loosely translates as supporting children with storybook reading. It's not a reading program, it's an oracy promotion program. So it's at the heart of it is about establishing really positive relationships with tutors, voluntary tutors in the most part, who work with these children for a minimum of 3 times a week for half an hour. And the book is like the prop, basically. So, you know, it's about doing, you know, sharing that book in a particular way. It's not just reading the book to the child, it's talking about the book, and it's about using a specific technique which is called the one-hand approach. And so if I was reading a book about, say I was reading a book about Perky the Pūkeka or whatever, then I would be looking at that. Usually we're choosing books that have a picture that goes across 2 pages, because that's the easiest for young children of sort of 4 to 6 to focus on that. It's not like one thing's happening on one side of the book and another thing's happening on the other side. So page that goes right across, and then we might say, oh, look, here's Perky over here. He's in the swamp. He's got really long legs that help him walk well in the swampy area. He's got a very red beak. And then you ask one question. So you're giving 4 statements of information and you're asking one question. And you're trying to ask an open question so that it would be, what do you think Perky's looking for? Instead of saying, is Perky's tail white? Yes or no? It's, what's he looking for? And then, you know, it's not so right or wrong. It's an open question. And I think that's one thing that is really helpful, not just for low language children, but if you have to ask a question, try and make it an open question, because the yes no questions just kill the conversation dead, you know. So the other thing is that I'd say about the one hand approach is 4 times as much information and then the question. Because maybe you don't notice this, but I notice it in myself, and I notice it a lot with adults, is that we ask kids questions all the time. And when they don't answer the question, guess what? We ask them another one. And for a child with really low language, I always say, that's like trying to take $500 out of a bank account with 50 cents. You're going to be an overdraft, you know, and it'll be a panicky feeling for the account holder. And that is what it's like for children with low language, is that when we do that thing about, and, you know, we all do it. I'm just more aware of it and try to do it a lot less. But, you know, children come home from school, you know, where's your bag? Did you eat all your lunch today? Have you got your sweatshirt? Who did you play with? What'd you learn? What do you do it? What class are you in? You know, how old are you? You know, so what I really encourage parents and tutors when I'm doing training is just to think about how you can make those statements, like, I met Nan for a cup of tea today, then we went to the grocery shopping. It was lucky I took my umbrella because it rained on the way home. And then you can say, tell me something you did today. You know, that's a very different scenario for a child than just boom, 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 you know, kind of cold its interrogation arrangements, even though that's not necessarily. But I know most people will say, I ask questions to get information. And I would say in return, you'll get more information if you give information. You know, so that's one tip I'd like to leave with you, is that when you find yourself doing the question, and we all do it, just have a think about how could you have made that into a statement. Because for our young children in particular, how they learn language is from hearing, you know, the language, the conversations, the stories that they hear on a daily basis. And this story could be as simple as, I really didn't want to get up this morning. When the alarm went, I thought, oh no. You know, because these are the kinds of things that happen in our day, you know, and when you can talk about that with your children, you help give them a kind of a spontaneous script for what they can use. Because I often find when children start at school, you know, low oracy children probably can't even tell me one thing they did before they got there. They probably haven't even got the words to tell me how they got there. It's not because they don't know stuff. It's because they don't have the words to express what they do know. And that has massive consequences, really massive consequences. And I'm just, I'll give you a scenario. Okay, so the kids are playing at lunchtime. There's a bit of an altercation in the sandpit. All right. The teacher on duty will ask what happened. Now, one of these kids will tell them what happened, well, their side of the story. The other one just shrugs their shoulders because they don't have the words to say, he wouldn't share that toy that he's been playing with all lunchtime and it was my turn. You know, so that's the kind of situation. And when you roll that forward 10 years, you've got 15-year-olds that may not be able to have those conversations either. And we do know that it makes a huge difference, because the research that we've done in New Zealand, and has been backed up with a lot of research from Australia and further afield, is that, you know, the inmates in the youth justice system or in, you know, centres have 6 to 7 times more likelihood of having language difficulties that were never addressed, often never even diagnosed as children. And, you know, and yet most of how we deliver rehabilitation is language based, and you have to go through a court system that's entirely language based. So you can see that the disadvantage starts from when they get picked up and not being able to explain that actually they weren't the one that started that altercation, it was someone else and they were just defending themselves. You know, if you can't tell your side of the story, then it becomes a one-sided story. And we don't always have the, you know, the resources. We've got a very small number of court-appointed communication assistants, but not nearly enough. And for a lot of young ones, they're ashamed that they can't figure out that system. It's intimidating enough, you know, being called on jury duty or something. I think when I went into, you know, to the Nelson courts, I was thinking, God, what if you had no language to figure this system out? You know, it's very hard when you've got it to imagine what it's like without it. So, you know, what someone said to me once, I think it was a psychologist I worked with in Christchurch, she said, behaviour is a form of communication. And if you don't have verbal communication, you will revert to other kinds of communication. And often what happens in our school system is that it's the behaviour that gets treated, not the underlying communication difficulty. So, you know, that's one of the things I think we have to be a lot better at, being able to assess that. But yeah, that, you know, that's why I do feel that this is a very disadvantaged group in our community. And what we've known from delivering the HPP program over 20 years, it doesn't take much to help these kids. Like, they respond really quickly if you get the right support in early. You know, they just blossom. They absolutely blossom. And these are kids who just, you know, when they're first coming to HPP, they won't look at you. They come over, they dawdle in. It's sort of like, oh my God, what are they going to ask me to do? To kind of developing a relationship with that tutor that's just there, just for them, and who, you know, I think if they're doing their job well, is going to be really positive with that young child and really encourage whatever they do say and take that and expand it and, you know, feed it back to them and just have fun, you know. And then you just see that amazing kind of transformation when children can start to communicate, you know, and actually learn that when I say kia ora to them, I expect them to say something back to me. I mean, a lot of the kids I work with don't even know that. They don't even know that when they're greeted, they're supposed to respond. So how does that happen? I don't know. But it's a really important thing. I mean, I have that issue with teenagers sometimes as well. I just think, no, I want, you know, this is ABC of communication. You need to understand that. And, you know, we do. We insist with with the little ones and they learn it. I mean, sometimes it's hard work, but they get there, you know, and they're chuffed with themselves when they do. And I can't remember the exact quote, but, you know, I do believe that there's few things that we can do that are sort of more disrespectful to children than accepting unacceptable behaviour. We don't do them any favours. They need to understand what's expected and be praised, definitely praised. I mean, mostly I say to the tutors, there's no wrong answers at HPP. It's just you haven't figured out where that came from. Because if this child had the words to explain, they will have responded in a way that makes sense to them, you know. So it's often just, you know, I have overheard some of the tutors sometimes going, yes, that might be, but I think it's possibly more likely to be this. And that's fine, you know, it's fine. But it's like we don't hit the wrong button because that's very discouraging for children when they're just kind of getting their water wings, if you like, with communication. So it has to be really nurtured, you know, really nurtured along. So, I mean, I was delighted to be, you know, I think coming to Spirited Conversations is, you know, that's what I would love for these young children to be having with their peers, spirited conversations, you know, because at five, basically, you know, what my training tells me is that at five you have your adult language. Yes, you'll add in, you know, specialised vocabulary, but if you are developing normally, your language is developing normally at 5 years of age, you should be able to argue, debate, ask questions, you know, have conversations, tell people how you feel, negotiate, you know. I mean, I'm sure lots of you have got grandchildren and that who could, you know, be working for the UN. Their negotiation skills are so darn good. And that's, you know, sometimes I would say that to the tutors, no, this is not Einstein, this is normal. This is normal. This is the language that a five-year-old should have. But if you're constantly working with five-year-olds who have the language of a two-and-a-half-year-old, you are going to think that kind of average development seems unbelievably sophisticated. So, you know, for the vast majority of the children that I've worked with over since the 80s, I would say that they're of average or above average intelligence. What I do know is if that language doesn't develop, that intelligence doesn't either. It will drop because, you know, it's kind of like, you know, how we say we learn to read and then we read to learn. Well, I think we learn to talk and then we talk to learn. You know, that's what's so important. It really does, you know, we have the neuroscience now that tells us talking and conversing and you know, having that toing and froing of language is what develops. It's what develops our brain. And for children, it's exceptionally important, you know. So, yeah, this is a group that I think it's growing. That's my kind of anecdotal experience, because teachers are talking all the time about children arriving at school with less and less language. And I think they've kind of identified the research that's been done in New Zealand in 2020, identified that time-poor households, increased device use, and poverty were probably, I mean, it can be a complex issue, but those are the three major contributors to poor oracy for our tamariki. So to me, they're all fixable. I don't know how much appetite there is for some of them, but they are certainly, you know, we can sort this out, but we can't if we keep doing the same as we've been doing for the last 20 odd years. I think, you know, then the future will be pretty grim for those tamariki. And I think what's happened in that 20-odd years too is that there were barely any private speech-language therapists when I did my training and came out, you know, to work in schools. And now there is just a plethora of them. And, you know, I heard one of the Radio New Zealand speech-language therapists say that, you know, if children had delayed language, no, they wouldn't meet the criteria, but they could go to a private therapist. But I wanted to ring in and say, if these low language kids come from the poorest households, do you really think that's going to happen? Because I would say the average cost for a speech therapist privately is probably $150 an hour, even if you knew that that was what needed to happen for your child. So, you know, I don't think that to me is not an answer. Well, it's not an adequate answer. So anyway, on a plus note, it is a grim situation. However, it can be fixed pretty simply, I reckon, because we know we've been doing this program for 20 years at Stoke School. It's been phenomenally successful. All its data is there to prove that. It was a program that was developed in the Bay of Plenty by a colleague of mine who grew up in Tairawhiti in the Gisborne area, and as a new entrant teacher and a speech language therapist, she was very aware of children arriving at school without that language they needed to engage with the curriculum. So she and a couple of her colleagues developed this program because they said it's no good sending our kids to reading recovery when there's no reading to recover. We need to develop that foundation of language. That's literacy develops from a foundation of strong language. So, you know, when I'm having those conversations with primary teachers and I say, why are you trying to teach a child who can't talk how to read? Why are you persisting with that? Is it just an exercise in frustration for both of you to see who's going to lose their rag first, or is there something behind this, you know? Because to me, it's like saying, this child's just crawling, but we've put him in a marathon, and it's not going to work. You can't leapfrog language and start reading. It doesn't work. You know, language and listening are biological processes. Reading and writing are not, you know. So they're very different. They come from very different places. And so, you know, what this colleague of mine had seen is that low-language children would be put on reading recovery programs. It would be like a revolving door. Yes, they'd get a bit of a bounce from the one-on-one attention, but they didn't hold it because it's like trying to develop sight vocab or something. But, you know, there comes a point when you're saturated with sight vocab and you can't work it out. But if you don't know that thing that goes over the water is called a bridge, it's kind of a meaningless exercise. So, you know, while the debate goes on and on about whether it's structured literacy or whole word literacy or whatever, I think that it doesn't matter what kind of literacy approach we have for low oracy kids, we have to deal with the oracy first. That's the important thing. And that should be the conversation that I'm hoping will start to go on a bit more. So we've launched Oracy Aotearoa. We did that last Tuesday. Very exciting. We've got a website, and we've got some promotional videos on the website, so, you know, with some of the children that we've worked with over the years at Stoke School. And, you know, what I guess the hope that I have is that everybody in our community can contribute to improve oracy. Don't have to be an expert, you know. Just reduce your questions, make them open questions, talk about what you're doing with young children. You know, and encourage them to talk back to you, not in a kind of a, you know, glaring at them way, but, you know, praise them when they respond to a greeting and those kinds of things. These are the ways that make oracy just flow for children. And, you know, I think about my own upbringing and how much input, you know, the adults in my life had to that. They explained lots of things they were doing. You know, you stand at the bench while Nan was baking or, you know, whatever. And, you know, they talk about mixing things and you tip the flour and it was going everywhere. But, hey, you were doing those things side by side and they were being talked about. Well, now when I observe adults, often with children in the supermarket, down at the aquatic centre, it's silence. It's silence. Or, you know, someone's got a device, someone's got the earplugs in. You know, that these things are kind of like robbing our kids of those opportunities to develop those oracy skills. So, yeah, I just think every one of us can be kind of spread the word. You know, that's what we want. Spread that word oracy. Talk about it. And I think doing more of these kinds of presentations might help with that as well, you know. But also we've got some cards here for our Oracy Aotearoa website, so I'm very happy for people to take those away. We're not too sure what the future is for Oracy Aotearoa because, you know, far out, we have no pūtea, no money at the moment to take it too much further, but we're working on maybe having a give a little page or something along those lines, because, you know, to me this is, everyone in our community will benefit from our children having better oracy skills, from our youth having better oracy skills, from our, you know, our grown-ups having good oracy skills. It's absolutely win-win as far as I see. So it's really worth putting some energy and resources into. So thanks for the opportunity. Kia ora.
That was Karina Shannon, recorded live at a spirited conversation at Yasa Cafe in Nelson during November. Spirited Conversations air Friday afternoon at 3, replaying the following Friday at the same time. Podcasts of this and previous episodes can also be found at freshfm.net and the accessmedia.nz app. Just look for Spirited Conversations. I'm Jan Marsh. Thanks for joining us for Spirited Conversations at Fresh FM.
The podcast you just listened to was a live recording of a radio show, first broadcast on Fresh FM, with support from New Zealand On Air. Fresh FM is a community access media station based in Te Tauihu, the top of the South Island, New Zealand. The funding of Access Media makes these podcasts possible. To find similar programs by other community access media stations, go online to accessmedia.nz. If you or your group would like to know more about how you can have a program on our station, please contact us. Visit our website, freshfm.net, for our contact details.